green strings were in some sense alive, perhaps male and female, while amber strings were dead strings. As appealing as this hypothesis was, it did not turn out to lead anywhere. Although a flurry of experimentation with a few billion random variations on strings 10,000 bits long did strongly suggest to the scientists that there were really three varieties of strings: red strings, green strings, and amber strings. And amber strings outnumbered the red and green strings by many, many orders of magnitude. See chapter 35 for more on this. Almost all strings were amber strings. That made the red-green regularity they had discovered all the more exciting and puzzling. What was it about the red strings that turned on the red light, and the green strings that turned on the green light? Of course, in each particular case, there was no mystery at all. The scientists could trace the causation of each particular string through the supercomputer in B and see that, with gratifying determinism, it produced its red or green or amber light, as the case might be. What they couldn't find, however, was a way of predicting which of the three effects a new string would have just by examining it without hand simulating its effect on box B. They knew from their empirical data that the odds were very high that any new string considered would be amber unless it was a string known to have been emitted by box A, in which case the odds were better than a billion to one that it would be either red or green. But no one could tell which without running it through box B to see how the program settled out. Perhaps the solution to the mystery lay in box A. They opened it up and found another supercomputer of a different make and model and running a different gigantic program, but also just a garden variety digital computer. They soon determined that there was an internal clock ticking away millions of times a second, and whenever they pushed either button, the first thing the computer did was take the time from the clock. For example, 101101010101010101, and break it up into strings, which it then used to determine which subroutines to call in which order, and which part of its memory to access first in the course of its preparation of a bit string to send down the wire. The scientists were able to figure out that it was this clock consulting, which was as good as random, that virtually guaranteed that the same bit string was never sent out twice. But in spite of this randomness or pseudo-randomness, it remained true that whenever they pushed button alpha, the bit string the computer concocted turned out to be red. And whenever they pushed button beta, the bit string eventually sent turned out to be green. Actually, the scientists did find a few anomalous cases. In roughly 1 in a billion trials, pushing the alpha button caused a green string to be emitted, or pushing the beta button caused a red string to be emitted. This tiny blemish in perfection only whetted the scientists' appetite for an explanation of the regularity. And then, one day, along came the two AI hackers who had built the boxes, and they explained it all. Do not listen further if you want to figure out the mystery for yourself. Al, who had built box A, had been working for years on an expert system, a database containing true propositions about everything under the sun, and an inference engine to deduce further implications from the axioms that composed the database. There were Major League Baseball statistics, meteorological records, biological taxonomies, histories of the world's nations, and hosts of trivia in the database. Bo, the Swede who had built Box B, had been working during the same time on a rival World Knowledge database for his own expert system. They had each stuffed their respective databases with as many truths as years of work had permitted. But as the years progressed, they had grown bored with expert systems, and both had decided that the practical promise of this technology was vastly overrated. The systems weren't actually very good at solving interesting problems, or thinking, or finding creative solutions to problems. All they were good at, thanks to their inference engines, was generating lots and lots of true sentences in their respective languages, and testing input sentences in their respective languages for truth and falsity relative to their sorta knowledge. So Al and Bo had gotten together and figured out how the fruits of their wasted effort could be put to use. They decided to make a philosophical toy. They chose a lingua franca for translating between their two representational systems. It was English, actually sent in standard ASCII code, and hooked the machines together with a wire, Whenever you pushed A's alpha button, this instructed A to choose at random, or pseudo-random, one of its beliefs, either a stored axiom or a generated implication of its axioms, translate it into English — in a computer, English characters would already be in ASCII — add enough random bits after the period to bring the total up to 10,000, and send the resulting string to B, which translated this input into its own language, which was Swedish Lisp, and tested it against its own beliefs, its database. Since both databases were composed of truths, and roughly the same truths, thanks to their inference engines, whenever A sent B something A believed, B believed it too, and signaled this by flashing a red light. Whenever A sent B what A took to be a falsehood, B announced that it judged that this was indeed a falsehood by flashing a green light. And whenever anyone tampered with the transmission, this almost always resulted in a string that was not a well-formed sentence of English, unless all the tampering occurred only in the random junk at the end. Since B had absolutely zero tolerance for typographical errors, B responded to these by flashing the amber light. Whenever anyone chose a bit string at random, the odds were vast that it would not be a well-formed truth or falsehood in English ASCII, hence the preponderance of amber strings. So, said Alan Bowe, the mysterious causal property red was actually the property of being a true sentence in English, and green was the property of being a falsehood in English. Suddenly, the search that had eluded the scientists for years became child's play. Anyone could compose red strings ad nauseum. Just write down the ASCII code for houses are bigger than peanuts, or whales don't fly, or 3 times 4 is 2 less than 2 times 7, for instance. If you wanted a green string, try 9 is less than 8, or New York is the capital of Spain. Philosophers soon hit on some cute tricks, such as finding strings that were red the first 100 times they were given to be, but green thereafter. For example, the ASCII for "this sentence has been sent to you for evaluation less than 101 times. But, said some philosophers, the string properties red and green are not really truth in English and falsity in English. After all, there are English truths whose ASCII expression takes millions of bits. And besides, in spite of their best efforts, Al and Bo didn't always insert facts in their programs. For example, some of what had passed for common knowledge when they were working on their databases had since been disproved. There were lots of reasons why the string property, the causal property, of redness was not quite exactly the property of truth in English. So perhaps red could be better defined as a relatively short expression in English ASCII of something sort of believed true by box B, whose sort of beliefs are almost all true. This satisfied some, but others picked nits, insisting for various reasons that this definition was inexact or had counterexamples that could not be ruled out in any non-ad hoc way, and so forth. But as Al and Bo pointed out, there were no better candidate descriptions of the property to be found. And hadn't the scientists been yearning for just such an explanation? Hadn't the mystery of red and green strings now been entirely dissolved? Moreover, now that it was dissolved, couldn't one see that there wasn't any hope at all of explaining the causal regularity with which we began our tale? All alphas cause reds, and all betas cause greens, without using some semantical or mentalistic terms. Some philosophers argued that while the newfound description of the regularity in the activity in the wire could be used to predict box B's behavior, it was not a causal regularity after all. Truth and falsehood, and any of the adjusted stand-ins just considered, are semantic properties, and as such are entirely abstract, and hence could not cause anything. Nonsense, others retorted. Pushing button alpha causes the red light to go on just as certainly as turning the ignition key causes your car to start. If it had turned out that what was being sent down the wire was simply high versus low voltage, or one pulse versus two, everybody would agree that this was an exemplary causal system. The fact that this system turned out to be a Rube Goldberg machine didn't show that the reliability of the link between alpha and red flashes was any less causal. In fact, in every single case, the scientists could trace out the exact microcausal path that explained the result. Convinced by this line of reasoning, other philosophers began to argue that this showed that the properties red, green, and amber weren't really semantical or mentalistic properties after all, but only imitation semantical properties, mere as-if semantical properties. What red and green were really were very, very complicated syntactical properties. These philosophers declined, however, to say anything further about just what syntactical properties these were, or to explain how even young children could swiftly and reliably produce instances of them, or recognize them. These philosophers were nevertheless convinced that there had to be a purely syntactic description of the regularity, since, after all, the causal systems in question were just computers, and computers are just syntactic engines, not capable of any real semanticity. "We suppose," retorted Alan Bowe, "that if you had found us inside our black boxes playing a trick on you by following the same scheme, you would then relent and agree that the operative causal property was genuine truth, or believe truth in any event. Can you propose any good reason for drawing such a distinction?" This led some to declare that in a certain important sense, Al and Bo had been in the boxes, since they were responsible for creating the respective databases as models of their own beliefs. It led others to denying that there really were any semantical or mentalistic properties anywhere in the world. Content, they said, had been eliminated. The debate went on for years, but the mystery with which we began was solved. Blocking the exits. The tale of the two black boxes ends there. Experience teaches, however, that there is no such thing as a thought experiment so clearly presented that no philosopher can misinterpret it. So, in order to forestall some of the most attractive misinterpretations, I will inelegantly draw attention to a few of the critical details and explain their roles in this intuition pump. 1. The devices in boxes A and B are nothing but automated encyclopedias. Not even walking encyclopedias, but just boxes of truths. Nothing in the story presupposes or implies that these devices are conscious, or thinking things, or even agents, except in the same minimal sense that a thermostat is an agent. They are utterly boring intentional systems, rigidly fixed to fulfilling a single, simple goal. The same is true of IBM's Watson, of course. They contain large numbers of true propositions and the inferential machinery necessary to generate more truths and to test for truth by testing a candidate proposition against their existing databases. 2. Since the two systems were created independently, they cannot plausibly be supposed to contain, actually or even virtually, exactly the same truths. But for the prank to work as well as I claim it did in the story, we must suppose a very large overlap, so that it was highly unlikely that a truth generated by A would not be recognized as such by B. Two considerations I claim make this plausible. 1. Al and Bo may live in different countries and have different native languages, but they inhabit the same world. And 2. Although there are gazillions of true propositions about that world, our world, the fact that both Al and Bo set out to create useful databases would guarantee a high degree of overlap between the two independently created systems. Although Al might know that on his 20th birthday his left foot was closer to the North Pole than the South Pole, and Bo had not forgotten that his first French teacher was named DuPont, these would not be truths that either one would likely put in their respective databases. If you doubt that the high degree of overlap between the two independently created systems, although Al might know that on his 20th birthday his left foot was closer to the North Pole than the South Pole, and Bo had not forgotten that his first French teacher was named DuPont, these would not be truths that either one would likely put in their respective databases. If you doubt that the mere fact that they were each intent on creating an internationally useful encyclopedia would ensure such a close correspondence between their respective databases, just add, as an inelegant detail, the convenient fact that during their years of hacking, they compared notes as to topics to be covered. 3. Why not have Al and Bob, a fellow American, or for that matter, why not simply have a duplicate of Al's system in Box B? Because it is critical to my story that no simple, feasibly discoverable syntactic matching up could explain the regularity. That is why Bo's system is in Swedish Lisp, to conceal from prying eyes the underlying semantic commonalities between the data structures consulted during A's sentence generation task and B's sentence translation and truth testing task. Computers, as physical systems, must be, at best, syntactic engines responding directly to physically transducible differences, not meanings. But both A and B have been designed to mirror as closely as possible the imaginary know-it-all, a semantic engine full of understood truths. When two different syntactic systems, A and B, have been designed to mirror the same semantic engine, the only way of accounting for the remarkable regularity they reveal is to ascend to the semantic engine level, where truths are believed and assertions are intended. The idea, then, was to create two systems that exhibited the fascinating regularity of external behavior described, but that were internally as different as possible, so that only the fact that their respective innards were systematic representations of a common world could explain the regularity. Recall that this was the theme in Chapter 13. We might pause to ask whether or not two such systems could ever be so inscrutable as to be invulnerable to reverse engineering. Or, in other words, could the scientists have remained baffled for so long? Cryptography has moved into such rarefied and arcane regions that one should think thrice at least before declaring either way. I have no idea whether anybody can make a sound argument that there are unbreakable encryption schemes or that there aren't. But, encryption aside, hackers will appreciate that all the convenient comments and other signposts one places in the source code when composing a program vanish when the source code is compiled, leaving behind an almost impossible to decipher tangle of machine instructions. Decompiling, reverse engineering the object code and recovering the source code, is sometimes possible in practice. Is it always possible in principle? Though it won't restore the comments, but just render salient the structures in the higher-level language. My assumption that the scientists' efforts at decompiling the program and deciphering the databases came to naught could be strengthened by postulating encryption if need be. In the story as told, we can agree that it is bizarre that the scientists never thought of checking to see if there was an ASCII translation of the bit streams running through the wire. How could they be so dense? Fair enough. You can fix this flaw in the thought experiment by sending the whole gadget, boxes A and B and the connecting wire, to Mars and let the alien scientists there try to figure out the regularity. The fact that all alphas cause red lights, all betas cause green lights, and random bit strings cause amber lights will be just as visible to them as to us, but they will be clueless about ASCII. To them, this gift from outer space will exhibit an utterly mysterious regularity, totally beyond all analytic probes, unless they hit on the idea that each box contains a description of a world, and that the descriptions are of the same world. It is the fact that each box bears multifarious semantic relationships to the same things, though expressed in different terminology and differently axiomatized, that grounds the regularity. When I tried this thought experiment out on Danny Hillis, the creator of the Connection Machine, a pioneering massively parallel computer built by his company, Thinking Machines, in the early 1980s, he thought immediately of a cryptographic solution to the puzzle, and then granted that my solution could be profitably viewed as a special case of his solution. Al and Bo were using the world as a one-time pad, an apt allusion to a standard technique of encryption. You can see the point by imagining a variation. You and your best friend are about to be captured by hostile forces, space pirates, let's say, who may know English but not much about your world. You both know Morse code and hit on the following impromptu encryption scheme. For a dash, speak a true sentence. For a dot, speak a false sentence. Your captors are permitted to listen to you two speak. Birds lay eggs and toads fly. Chicago is a city and my feet are not made of tin and baseball is played in August. You say, answering, no, dash dot, dash dash dash, to whatever your friend has just asked. The next time you need to say no, you use different sentences. Even if your captors know Morse code, unless they also can determine the truth and falsity of these sentences, they cannot detect the properties that stand for dot and dash. This variation could be added to our fable for spice as follows. Instead of shipping the computer systems in the boxes to Mars, we put Al and Bo in the boxes and ship them to Mars. The Martians will be as puzzled by Al and Bo, if they play the Morse code prank, as by the computers, unless they draw the conclusion, obvious to us but we are not Martians, that these things in the boxes are to be semantically interpreted. The point of the fable is simple. There is no substitute for the intentional stance. Either you adopt it and explain the pattern by finding the semantic level facts, or you will forever be baffled by the regularity, the causal regularity, that is manifestly there. At this juncture, if you are like many philosophers, you may once again be attracted by the claim that this intuition pump works only because boxes A and B are artifacts whose intentionality, such as it is entirely derived and artifactual. The data structures in their memories get their reference, if they get any at all, by indirect reliance on the sense organs, life histories, and purposes of their creators, Al and Bo. The real source of the meaning or truth or semanticity in the artifacts lies in these human artificers. Al and Bo have original intentionality, and A and B have only derived intentionality. That was, of course, the point of the suggestion that, in a certain sense, Al and Bo were in their respective boxes. I might have told the story differently. Inside the boxes were two robots, Al and Bo, each of which had spent a longish lifetime scurrying around the world gathering facts before getting in their respective boxes. I chose a simpler route to forestall all the questions about whether box A or box B was really thinking. But if you want to reconsider the thought experiment with this complication, note that the intuition pump about the giant robot survival machine has already cast doubt on the otherwise compelling idea that genuine intentionality could not arise in any artifact. Summary. 21 thinking tools, a dozen intuition pumps, and some useful concepts lined up and put to work on the foundational concept of meaning. What have we made with their help? Do they all work well? Notice that there are two ways an intuition pump may prove valuable. If it's well made, then either the intuitions it pumps are reliable and convincing, in which case it nicely blocks some otherwise tempting path of error, or the intuitions still seem dubious, in which case the intuition pump may help focus attention on what is wrong with its own presuppositions. In either case, the tool is a sort of lever, like a seesaw. If one side goes up, the other side must go down, but only if the tool can't bend or break in the middle. Intuition pumps are more complicated than seesaws, so we need to turn the knobs. That's what I just did with the two black boxes, but there are no doubt other knobs to check before settling for its verdict. And what are the verdicts of this long section on meaning? A mixture of pessimism and optimism. Meaning isn't going to turn out to be a simple property that maps easily onto brains, and we're not going to find deeper facts anywhere that just settle the question of what a sentence or a thought or a belief really means. The best we can do, and it is quite good enough, is to find an anchor, apparently, best interpretations of all the physical stance and design stance data we have. If we can find one solution to a Quinean quandary about meaning, we have almost certainly found the solution, in the sense that we may be confident that no better solution lies undiscovered. As the two Bitzers moved to Panama showed, meaning is always relative to a context of function, and there need be no original intentionality beyond the intentionality of our sorta selfish genes, which derive their sorta intentionality from the functional context of evolution by natural selection, instead of from an intelligent designer playing the role of our rich client ordering a giant robot. And the intuition pump about the two black boxes shows that the intentional stance, with all its tolerance of sorta beliefs and their ilk, is not optional if you want to understand and explain many of the causal regularities in the world. Our investigations into these issues are greatly enhanced here in the 21st century by the fact that, for the first time, we have ways of thinking rigorously and vigorously about mechanisms with trillions of moving parts, parts that work in unmysterious ways. Thanks to Turing, we can at least dimly see a path now from brute, uncomprehending matter, the physical stance, via a cascade of rearrangements, the design stance and sort of meanings, to an appreciation of ourselves as paradigmatic believers, knowers, understanders, simplified by the intentional stance as intentional systems. Every one of these propositions is or has been controversial, and there are still plenty of experts who haven't signed on to all of them. Perhaps lining up all these propositions will increase their persuasive power, and we'll get a critical mass phenomenon that attracts those who haven't seen the way the parts mesh so nicely. On the other hand, lining them up like this may make it easier for critics to find a common thread of mistake running through them. Either way, we make progress. Or maybe we'll discover sleight of hand in many of them, obscuring the truth instead of illuminating it. To find flaws, go back and turn the knob some more and see what happens. At the very least, discovering such flaws amounts to a sour kind of progress. The progress of exposing tempting bad ideas, something philosophers have been doing for millennia. I don't claim that this section gives us a theory of meaning. It gives us only a rather commodious logical space in which a proper scientific theory of meaning must fit, if I am right. Now that we have the content side of the mind roughly pinned in place, can we turn to that grand mystery of mysteries, consciousness? Not yet. We need to build some more foundations. Too many issues that arise in the quest to understand consciousness have implications about, or presuppositions about, evolution, as we have already seen in this section. Many of the themes we've begun developing have appealed to evolutionary considerations, so let's get them exposed and clarified before we go on. Besides, it's an endlessly fascinating topic. 6. Tools for thinking about evolution. Darwin's idea of evolution by natural selection is, in my opinion, the single best idea that anybody has ever had, because in a single bold stroke, it unites meaning with matter, two aspects of reality that appear to be worlds apart. On one side, we have the world of our minds and their meanings, our goals, our hopes, and our yearnings, and that most honored, and hackneyed, of all philosophical topics, the meaning of life. On the other side, we have galaxies ceaselessly wheeling, planets falling pointlessly into their orbits, lifeless chemical mechanisms doing what physics ordains, all without purpose or reason. Then Darwin comes along and shows us how the former arises from the latter, creating meaning as it goes, a bubble-up vision of the birth of importance to overthrow the trickle-down vision of tradition. The idea of natural selection is not very complex, but it is so powerful that some people cannot bear to contemplate it, and they desperately avert their attention as if it were a horrible dose of foul-tasting medicine. Here are some thinking tools to help us see how this idea illuminates the dark corners of existence, turning mysteries into puzzles that we can solve and uncovering the glories of nature as never before. 34. Universal acid. Did you ever hear of universal acid? This fantasy used to amuse me and some of my schoolboy friends. I have no idea whether we invented or inherited it along with Spanish fly and saltpeter as part of an underground youth culture. Universal acid is a liquid so corrosive that it will eat through anything. But what do you keep it in? It dissolves glass bottles and stainless steel canisters as readily as paper bags. What would happen if you somehow came upon or created a dollop of universal acid? Would the whole planet eventually be destroyed? What would it leave in its wake? After everything had been transformed by its encounter with universal acid, what would the world look like? Little did I realize that in a few years, I would encounter an idea, Darwin's idea, bearing an unmistakable likeness to universal acid. It eats through just about every traditional concept, and leaves in its wake a revolutionized worldview, with most of the old landmarks still recognizable, but transformed in fundamental ways. Many Darwin dreaders missed the point, deliberately, when I introduced this image of Darwin's dangerous idea in 1995. I went to some lengths to reassure my readers that after the universal acid swept through their favorite topics, ethics, art, culture, religion, humor, and, yes, even consciousness, what would be left behind would be just as wonderful, even more wonderful in many regards, but subtly transformed. Darwin's idea is a revolutionary idea. No doubt about it, but it does not destroy what we value in all these things. It puts them on better foundations and unites them gracefully with the rest of knowledge. For centuries, the arts and humanities have been considered not just separate from the sciences, but somehow protected from the invasive examinations science engages in. But this traditional isolation is not the best way to preserve what we love. Trying to hide our treasures behind a veil of mystery prevents us from finding a proper anchoring for them in the physical world. It is a common enough mistake, especially in philosophy. When people sense that something they love is under threat, their first reaction is to build an impenetrable wall, a Maginot line. And just to be extra safe, they decide to enclose a bit more territory, a buffer zone inside its fortifications. It seems like a good, prudent idea. It seems to protect us from the awful slippery slope, the insidious thin edge of the wedge. And as everyone knows, if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. Dig the moat. Build the wall. And as far out as you can afford. But this policy typically burdens the defenders with a brittle, extravagant, implausible, indefensible set of dogmas that cannot be defended rationally and hence must be defended, in the end, with desperate clawing and shouting. In philosophy, this strategic choice often shows up as absolutism of one kind or another. The sanctity of human life is infinite. At the core of great art lies divine and inexplicable genius. Consciousness is a problem too hard for us mere mortals to understand. And, one of my favorite targets, what I call hysterical realism. There are always deeper facts that settle the puzzle cases of meaning. These facts are real, really real, even if we are systematically unable to discover them. This is a tempting idea, in part, because it appeals to our sense of proper human modesty. Who are we to say that there just aren't any facts to settle these issues? Einstein's notorious resistance to the indeterminacy of quantum physics is an august example of the appeal of this idea. "God does not play dice," was his heartfelt but ultimately unreasonable ground for resistance. And when you get right down to it, who are we, or who is Einstein, to say that God doesn't play dice? This is probably not the way to deal with such issues, and we'll see some opportunities for hysterical realism and see how to resist it later. Evolutionary thinking is a fine antidote. 35. The Library of Mendel, Vast and Vanishing. The human genome has now been sequenced by Craig Venter and others. But what does this mean? Isn't everybody's DNA different? Yes. So different, in fact, that even a rather small fragment of DNA found at a crime scene is enough to identify its owner with over 99% certainty. And yet, human DNA is also so similar that scientists can distinguish it from the DNA of other species given only fragments of a complete genome. How is this possible? How can our personal DNA be so different and yet so similar? A good way to understand this surprising fact is by comparing DNA with the texts of books. And the Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges, 1962, has given us a little fable, The Library of Babel, that vividly illustrates the way this difference and similarity can coexist. Borges tells of the forlorn explorations and speculations of people who find themselves living in a vast storehouse of books, structured like a honeycomb, composed of thousands, or millions or billions, of hexagonal air shafts surrounded by balconies lined with shelves. Standing at a railing and looking up or down, no one can see a top or bottom to these shafts, and nobody has ever found a shaft that isn't surrounded by six neighboring shafts. The people wonder, is the warehouse infinite? Eventually they decide that it is not, but it might as well be, for it seems that on its shelves, in no order alas, lie all the possible books. Suppose that each book is 500 pages long, and each page consists of 40 lines, with 50 spaces for each line, so there are 2,000 character spaces per page. Each space either is blank or has a character printed on it, chosen from a set of 100 characters, the uppercase and lowercase letters of English and other European languages, plus the blank and punctuation marks. Somewhere in the Library of Babel is a volume consisting entirely of blank pages, and another volume is all question marks, but the vast majority consist of typographical gibberish. No rules of spelling or grammar, to say nothing of sense, prohibit the inclusion of a volume. 500 pages multiplied by 2,000 characters per page gives 1,000,000 character spaces per book. So, if we were to fill the books with every permutation of the characters, there would be 100 to the 1,000,000th power different books in the Library of Babel. Since it is estimated that there are only 100 to the 40th power, give or take a few, particles, protons, neutrons, and electrons in the region of the universe we can observe, the Library of Babel is not remotely a physically possible object. But thanks to the strict rules with which Borges constructed it in his imagination, we can think about it clearly. Is this truly the set of all possible books? Obviously not, since they are restricted to being printed from only 100 different characters, excluding, we may suppose, the characters of Greek, Russian, Arabic, and Chinese, thereby overlooking many of the most important actual books. Of course, the library does contain superb translation of these actual books into English, French, German, Italian, and so on, as well as uncountable trillions of shoddy translations of each book. Books of more than 500 pages are there, beginning in one volume and continuing without a break into other volumes. It is amusing to think about some of the volumes that must be somewhere in the Library of Babel. One of them is the best, most accurate 500-page biography of you, from the moment of your birth until the moment of your death. Locating it, however, would be all but impossible, since the library also contains gazillions of volumes that are magnificently accurate biographies of you up until your 10th, 20th, 30th, 40th birthday and so on, and completely false about subsequent events of your life, in a gazillion different and diverting ways. But even finding one readable volume in this huge storehouse is unlikely in the extreme. We need some terms for the quantities involved. The Library of Babel is not infinite, so the chance of finding anything interesting in it is not literally infinitesimal. These words exaggerate in a familiar way, but we should avoid them. Unfortunately, all the standard metaphors, astronomically large, a needle in a haystack, a drop in the ocean, fall comically short. No actual astronomical quantity, such as the number of elementary particles in the universe or the amount of time since the Big Bang measured in nanoseconds, is even visible against the backdrop of these huge but finite numbers. If a readable volume in the library were as easy to find as a particular drop in the ocean, we'd be in business. Dropped at random into the library, our chance of ever encountering a volume with so much as a grammatical sentence in it is so vanishingly small that we might do well to capitalize the term. Vanishingly small, and give it a mate, vastly, short for very much more than astronomically. Here's another way of getting some sense about just how ridiculously large the Library of Babel is. As just noted, only a vanishingly small subset of the books is composed of English words. That subset is itself vast, and a vanishing subset within it consists of books in which the words are arranged in grammatical sentences. The vast majority consist of volumes filled with word strings like this. Good since Paris helping easy from which nevertheless democracy striptease tigers. A vast but vanishing subset of the grammatical books is composed of sentences that make sense in sequence. The rest are composed of sentences that might be chosen at random from books in grammatical English. A vast but vanishing subset of those sense-making books are about somebody named John. And a vast but vanishing subset of those are about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and a still vast but vanishing subset of those are true. And a vast but vanishing subset of those true books about the assassination of Kennedy are composed entirely of limericks. Yes, there are more possible true books in limericks about the death of JFK than there are volumes in the Library of Congress. Not a single one has been published, in all likelihood, which is just as well. Moby Dick is in the Library of Babel, but so are 100,000,000 mutant imposters that differ from the canonical Moby Dick by a single typographical error. That's not yet a vast number, but the total rises swiftly when we add the variants that differ by 2 or 10 or 1,000 typos. Even a volume with 1,000 typos, 2 per page on average, would be unmistakably recognizable as Moby Dick. And there are vastly many of those volumes. It wouldn't matter which of these volumes you found, if only you could find one of them. Almost all of them would be equally wonderful reading, and all tell the same story except for truly negligible, almost indiscriminable, differences. Not quite all of them, however. Sometimes, a single typo in a crucial position can be fatal. Peter DeVries, another philosophically delicious writer of fiction, once published a novel that began, "Call me, Ishmael." Oh, what a single comma can do. Or consider the many mutants that begin with, "Ball me, Ishmael." In Borges's story, the books are not shelved in any order, but even if we found them scrupulously alphabetized, we would have insoluble problems finding the book we were looking for. For instance, the essential version of Moby Dick. Imagine traveling by spaceship through the Moby Dick galaxy of the Library of Babel. This galaxy is in itself vastly larger than the whole physical universe. So no matter what direction you go in, for centuries on end, even if you travel at the speed of light, all you see are virtually indistinguishable copies of Moby Dick. You will never, ever reach anything that looks like anything else. David Copperfield is unimaginably distant in this space. Even though we know that there is a path, the shortest path, ignoring the gazillions of others, leading from one great book to the other by single typographical changes. If you found yourself on this path, you would find it almost impossible to tell, by local inspection, which direction to go to move toward David Copperfield, even if you had texts of both target books in hand. In other words, this logical space is so vast that many of our usual ideas about location, about searching and finding and other such mundane and practical activities, have no straightforward application. Borges put the books on the shelves in random order, a nice touch from which he drew several delectable reflections. But look at the problems he would have created for himself if he had tried to arrange them in alphabetical order. Since there are only 100 different alphabetic characters, in our version, we can treat some specific sequence of them as alphabetical order. For example, lowercase a, capital A, lowercase b, capital B, lowercase c, capital C, to lowercase z, capital Z, question mark, semicolon, comma, period, exclamation point, close parentheses, open parentheses, percentage, etc. Then we can put all the books beginning with the same character on the same floor. Now our library is only 100 stories high, shorter than the Sears or Willis Tower in Chicago. We can divide each floor into 100 corridors, each of which we line with the books whose second character is the next character in alphabetical order. On each corridor, we can place 100 shelves, one for each third character slot. Thus, all the books that begin with "Aardvarks Love Mozart," and how many they are shelved on the same shelf, the R shelf, in the first corridor on the first floor. But that's a mighty long shelf. So perhaps we had better stack the books in file drawers at right angles to the shelf, one drawer for each fourth letter position. That way, each shelf can be only, say, 100 feet long. But now the file drawers are awfully deep, and will run into the backs of the file drawers in the neighboring corridor, so... But we've run out of dimensions in which to line up the books. We need a million-dimensional space to store all the books neatly, and all we have is three dimensions: up, down, left, right, and front, back. So we will just have to pretend we can imagine a multidimensional space, each dimension running at right angles to all the others. We can conceive of such hyperspaces, as they are called, even if we can't visualize them. Scientists use them all the time to organize the expression of their theories. The geometry of such spaces, whether or not they count as only imaginary, is well-behaved and well-explored by mathematicians. We can confidently speak about locations, paths, trajectories, volumes, hypervolumes, distances, and directions in these logical spaces. we are now prepared to consider a variation on Borges's theme, which I will call the Library of Mendel. This library contains all possible genomes, DNA sequences. Richard Dawkins, 1986, describes a similar space which he calls biomorph land in The Blind Watchmaker. His discussion is the inspiration for mine, and our two accounts are entirely compatible. But I want to stress some points he chose to pass over lightly. If we consider the Library of Mendel to be composed of descriptions of genomes, then it is already a proper part of the Library of Babel. The standard code for describing DNA consists of only four characters, A, C, G, and T, standing for adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, the four kinds of nucleotides. All the 500-page permutations of these four letters, therefore, are already in the Library of Babel. Typical genomes are much longer than ordinary books, however. The human genome has approximately 3 billion nucleotides, so the exhaustive description of a single human genome, such as your own, would take approximately 3,000 of the 500-page volumes in the Library of Babel. This comparison of a human genome with the volumes in the galaxy of Moby Dick now gives us the explanation we need of the difference and similarity between human genomes. How can we speak of sequencing, copying down, the human genome, if every human genome is different from every other in not just one, but hundreds or thousands of places, loci in the language of genetics? Like the proverbial snowflakes or fingerprints, no two actual human genomes are exactly alike, including those of identical twins. The chance of typos creeping in is always present, even in the cells of a single individual. Human DNA is readily distinguishable from the DNA of any other species, even that of the chimpanzee, which is the same at over 90% of the loci. Every actual human genome that has ever existed is contained within a galaxy of possible human genomes that is vastly distant from the galaxies of other species' genomes. Yet, within the galaxy, there is plenty of room for no two human genomes to be alike. You have two versions of each of your genes, one from your mother and one from your father. They passed on to you exactly half of their own genes, randomly selected from those they received from their parents, your grandparents. But since your grandparents were also members of Homo sapiens, their genomes agree at almost all loci, so it makes no difference most of the time which grandparent provides either of your genes. But their genomes nevertheless differ at many thousands of loci, and in those slots, which genes you get is a matter of chance, a coin toss built into the machinery for forming your parents' contribution to your DNA. Moreover, mutations accumulate at the rate of about 100 per genome per generation in mammals. That is, your children will have 100 differences from you and your spouse in their genes as a result of random copying errors by your enzymes, or as a result of mutations in your ovaries or testicles caused by cosmic rays. Ridley, 1993, page 45. The description of the genome for a horse or a cabbage or an octopus would be composed of the same letters, A, C, G, and T. Most animal genomes measured are smaller than the human genome, but some plants have genomes more than 10 times larger than ours, and some single-celled amoebas have genomes even larger. Amoeba dubia is the current world record holder, with an estimated 670 billion base pairs, more than 200 times larger than ours. But let us suppose, arbitrarily, that the Library of Mendel consists of all of the DNA strings described in all of the 3,000-volume boxed sets consisting entirely of those four characters. This will capture enough of the possible genomes to serve any serious theoretical purpose. I have overstated the case in describing the Library of Mendel as containing all possible genomes, just as the Library of Babel ignored the Russian and Chinese languages. So the Library of Mendel ignores the apparent possibility of alternative genetic alphabets based on different chemical constituents, for instance. So any conclusions we come to regarding what is possible relative to this Library of Mendel may have to be reconsidered when we try to apply them to some broader notion of possibility. This is actually a strength rather than a weakness of our tactic, since we can keep close tabs on exactly what sort of modest, circumscribed possibility we are talking about. One of the important features of DNA is that all the permutations of sequences of adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine are about equally stable chemically. All could be constructed, in principle, in the gene splicing laboratory, and once constructed, they would have an indefinite shelf life, like a book in a library. But not every such sequence in the Library of Mendel corresponds to a viable organism. Most DNA sequences, the vast majority, are gibberish, recipes for nothing living at all. All the genomes that we see that actually exist today are the products of billions of years of adjustment and revision, a mindless editorial process that is effective because most of the gibberish, all but a vanishingly thin thread of meaningful, useful text, is automatically discarded, while the rest is relentlessly reused, copied gazillions of times. You have more than a trillion copies of your genome in your own body right now, one copy in each human cell. And every day, as new skin cells and bone cells and blood cells are made, new copies of your genomes are installed in them. The text that can be copied, because it resides in a going concern, a living cell, is copied. The rest dissolves. Publish or perish. 36. Genes as words or subroutines. The analogy between genes and words is useful, as we have just seen, but there is a better one that we are now equipped to understand, thanks to the interlude about computers. In his masterpiece, The Ancestor's Tale, Richard Dawkins, 2004, gives credit to another brilliant writer on evolution, Matt Ridley, for pointing out the deep similarities between genes and software subroutines in his book, Nature via Nurture. I would not ordinarily insert such a long quotation of somebody else's work in a book of mine, but I found that my attempts at paraphrasing this passage invariably sacrificed clarity and vividness for a smidgen of originality. So, with his permission, I am passing along the unmutated version as it appears in Dawkins's book. Most of the genome that we sequence is not the book of instructions or master computer program for building a human or a mouse, although parts of it are. If it were, we might indeed expect our program to be larger than the mouse's. But most of the genome is more like the dictionary of words available for writing the book of instructions, or, we shall soon see, the set of subroutines that are called by the master program. As Ridley says, the list of words in David Copperfield is almost the same as the list of words in The Catcher in the Rye. Both draw upon the vocabulary of an educated native speaker of English. The difference between the two books is the order in which those words are strung together. When a person is made, or when a mouse is made, both embryologies draw upon the same dictionary of genes, the normal vocabulary of mammalian embryologies. The difference between a person and a mouse comes out of the different orders with which the genes, drawn from that shared mammalian vocabulary, are deployed, the different places in the body where this happens, and its timing. All this is under the control of particular genes whose business it is to turn other genes on in complicated and exquisitely timed cascades. But such controlling genes constitute only a minority of the genes in the genome. Don't misunderstand order as meaning the order in which the genes are strung out along the chromosomes. With notable exceptions, the order of genes along a chromosome is as arbitrary as the order in which words are listed in a vocabulary, usually alphabetical, but, especially in phrasebooks for foreign travel, sometimes an order of convenience. Words useful in airports, words useful when visiting the doctor, words useful for shopping, and so on. The order in which genes are stored on chromosomes is unimportant. What matters is that the cellular machinery finds the right gene when it needs it, and it does this using methods that are becoming increasingly well understood. In one respect, the analogy with words is misleading. Words are shorter than genes, and some writers have likened each gene to a sentence. But sentences aren't a good analogy for a different reason. Different books are not put together by permuting a fixed repertoire of sentences. Most sentences are unique. Genes, like words but unlike sentences, are used over and over again in different contexts. A better analogy for a gene than either a word or a sentence is a toolbox subroutine in a computer. The Mac has a toolbox of routines stored in ROM, read-only memory, or in system files permanently loaded at startup time. There are thousands of these toolbox routines, each one doing a particular operation, which is likely to be needed over and over again in slightly different ways in different programs. For example, the toolbox routine called obscure cursor hides the cursor from the screen until the next time the mouse is moved. Unseen by you, the obscure cursor gene is called every time you start typing and the mouse cursor vanishes. Toolbox routines lie behind the familiar feature shared by all programs on the Mac and their imitated equivalents on Windows machines. Pull-down menus, scroll bars, shrinkable windows that you can drag around the screen with the mouse, and many others. Dawkins, 2004, pages 155 to 156. All this helps us understand why it is so easy for an expert to recognize the genome of a mammal. It has the mammal toolbox, which, in addition to its specialized mammal-making tools, also includes tools from the reptile toolbox and the fish toolbox and even the worm toolbox. The oldest tools in the kit are shared by all living things, including bacteria. 37. The Tree of Life. The genomes that exist today are connected by threads of descent to the genomes of their parents and grandparents and so on, back to the beginning of life on Earth. The image of the Tree of Life shows how every person is relatively closely related to every other person, sharing common human ancestors within the last 100,000 years, and sharing ancestors with every dog and whale within the last 200 million years, and every daisy and redwood tree within the last 2 billion years. There are many ways of drawing the Tree of Life. In mine, the present is represented along the outer tips of the branches. Only the lineages still alive reach this outer rim. Dinosaurs, except for the birds that descended from them, are shown to have gone extinct over 60 million years ago. All the threads are connected eventually back at the origin of life, about which more later. If we enlarged the diagram a trillionfold, we could see the family trees of every fly, fish, and frog that ever lived, seeing which died childless, most of them, of course, and which had progeny.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.